Hi there once again. So happy to have you with us once again this week on Leading Edge. I'm your host, Jeff Smith. We are talking about Toledo hosting another Italian Bowl football game. And two local coaches share their thoughts on a new study about the pressures of youth sports 24/7, 365 days a year. But first, deplorable living conditions. That was the description for what residents in two Toledo apartment complexes were dealing with. Since the news broke, Ashland Manor and Covenant House Apartments here in Toledo now have the city's attention. And two council people joining me here today are saying, no more of this. Not on my watch. Venice Williams and Sandra McPherson both joining us. Nice enough to spend some time talking about this, even though, as you said, Venice, it has taken up pretty much every day, every minute of your calendar for the last 2-3 weeks. So yeah. I guess bring us up to speed. Are we at a better situation right now than we were?
I think so. As of today, Ashland Manor is cleaned up.
Walked through.
I did.
You were disgusted.
I actually vomited. I vomited twice at the smell.
And you were saddened.
I was more than saddened. I come from poverty. I used to live in affordable housing or low-income housing. My mother was on Section 8 most of my life, and in my adult years, 18 and up, I lived in low-income apartments. So I take it personal. So it was more than saddened. It was anger. It was bad. I actually can't put it into words all the feelings that I had being in that building.
But you said it's gotten improved somewhat.
It's gotten improved somewhat, especially Ashland Manor. Ashland Manor has been cleaned up. The city actually stepped in right then and there. I was in a meeting after I visited the Ashland Manor with the deputy mayor, Karen Poor, and her and I, and Director Rosalind Clemens. We all three of us said, neither one of us are going to be able to go to sleep unless we know that that trash is taken care of. So we went into work at that point. Then it was, we need to put up some money to get this cleaned out. We have to take this initiative to get this cleaned up, and we needed to do it ASAP. So the very next day, Clum was hired to come out and clean the trash chute, and Clum actually hired Frames. The city was going to...
Pest control.
Yeah. Frames Pest Control. They cleaned out everything and got everything working and got everything exterminated. I was there waiting and watching and making sure that everything was getting done because we had the press conference that
day. Floor by floor.
Floor by floor, eight floors.
Yeah.
It was disgusting. Nobody should ever, ever, ever live in those conditions. And that's why I had to do the press conferences. We have to take ownership of us as the city. We have to take ownership of making sure our landlords are doing what they're supposed to do. These are people's homes.
And that is the biggest thing, Sir Sandra. And you and I texted back and forth, and I said, is the city council doing anything? You said that is the question right now. What can we do? That's what you're looking into.
Yes, because I went and walked through. I could not believe that people were actually living in those conditions. The smell was unbelievable.
And I asked,
the doors are not locked, no safety. Nobody deserves to live like that. Yes.
Okay. There are locks on the doors now. Or working
they
locks?
They're working on the locks, but they have security now.
Okay.
So they have security on staff 24/7.
Let me ask you this. You said, and because the question has come up, you know, how much falls on the residents? How much falls on the responsibility of the city? How much falls on the responsibility of the owners of the building? What was your answer?
This part is on the persons that own the building. People can call and ask for help. There's a system in apartment complexes where you fill out and you... But when there's nobody functioning in the building, everybody's quit, what do the people then do?
They're left on an island. And Venice, you said numbers have been called, help has been asked for, and it just goes unanswered.
Well, and also, too, I'll say this. The management, this is what we've been told. We've been told that because of the crime that's in that area, management walked off. Crime has been in that area for decades. Mm-hmm. Management walked off because attitude reflects leadership. And if the owners of the company are not taking ownership to reinforce what the management is doing or putting dollars in to create an environment and change the culture of the building, then I would walk off as well. It is not the fault of the people that left that place, because attitude reflects leadership in everything we do in life. And that was on the owners. That was definitely on the owners, because the manager creates the culture, but the manager has to feel empowered to maintain that culture.
We've had comments from Sherrod Brown. He has made it sound like this coordination, this effort is long overdue. Mm-hmm. Obviously, bring it to his attention. It's going to get a reaction. The mayor's in D.C. talking with HUD officials, Housing and Urban Development. My question to both of you is, how likely, and I'll start with you, Sir Sandra, how likely is it that we get boots on the ground from a federal standpoint?
We're making that happen. And the one thing that we talked about, we've been in meetings, we have a meeting tomorrow, is to stop the money flow.
We're taping on Thursday, by the way. The meeting's happening Friday.
Yes.
Okay.
Stop the flow of money.
Who's that meeting with?
Task force. Sherrod Brown's office mm-hmm. is heading it up. And so it'll be a Zoom meeting. But they're getting...
Will we see federal people here?
Yes.
Taking
and
action?
Have.
They have. I got a... The mayor was in D.C. Mm-hmm. on... This past Thursday, and he met with Marsha Fudge on Wednesday. I received an email Wednesday night from a HUD official that they would be here Thursday morning, and I met with HUD officials locally while he was meeting with them mm-hmm. in D.C. HUD has been very responsive this go-around, and I will say this. This task force in Toledo is not new. We had a task force with the Greenbelt Apartments. We had Marcy Capture's office. We had Sherrod Brown's office. We had this task force. We partnered with the county commissioners. Right. We have Tina Butts and her organization, The Movement. We actually had boots on the ground when Greenbelt was an issue for us. We worked hard and as a collaborative effort cleaning up the Greenbelt Apartments, and we currently still are maintaining that relationship with the Greenbelt owners. So it has been something that is not new to us. Mm-hmm. Now, the task force that now HUD wants to be involved with so that we can create some type of system to be proactive is amazing.
Two more questions. One, you said something before we came on today. You said specifically about lifting people up, making them not realize this is their normal.
Yes.
What was that?
Because if you have lived in a condition and have been conditioned to live in this condition, nothing changes.
You know no different.
You know no different. But if you are taught and brought up, you are deserving of a clean place to live, a place, an environment that does not contain rodents and garbage. You deserve it. And our citizens here in Toledo deserve it. And we're going to make sure that these people that own these apartment complexes that are getting the dollars, that don't live in our city, that don't support, we're holding you accountable. The buck stops here with Toledo City Council. And we're making that happen, and we're going to stand on it.
Venice, 30 seconds. I just want to ask, how many more of these apartment complexes do we not know about?
It's several. And that's why City Council is working with the administration and with our local Congresswoman's office and our senator's office. J.D. Vance actually reached out as well. We're going to work together to create something where we're not going to be reactive anymore. We're going to be proactive. So those apartment complexes that aren't doing right by people and taking care of those homes for the people, like the contract and lease says, we're coming for you.
We're going to hold you accountable.
Ladies.
We're going to write legislation to make sure mm-hmm. that we hold you accountable.
And how soon will that be done?
We're working on it right now.
It won't be long at all.
Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
Absolutely. We'll be back right after this. Welcome back. Fresh off the success and surprise attendance to the Italian Bowl in July of 2023, the game will make a return visit stateside in 2025. And part of the contingent responsible for bringing it here and putting the plan together to bring it back, Nick Guy joining me here on Leading Edge. Good to see you. Thanks for doing this.
Thanks for having me, Jeff.
Let's talk about, I guess, just first and foremost, how well this did for the city of Toledo, because it was kind of one of those grandiose ideas at the start. You bring something like this stateside to little old Toledo, Ohio. Was it labeled a success?
Oh, certainly. I mean, like you said, it was kind of stepping into the great unknown or the great beyond mm-hmm. of not knowing how this community would receive something like this. It's kind of very foreign.
Yeah.
literally.
Well done. Yeah. I see what you did there.
To do that, to bring what is the first European championship of any sport outside of its own country and play it in the state of Ohio was something new. And to see the way that the community and the people, the city, all the businesses step up and say, hey, this is something interesting. This makes a lot of sense, and we want to be a part of it.
Take me back to the sales pitch, the marketing for it, and how you get somebody to bite.
Yeah, so for me, I obviously have an affinity for this league because I played in it, and it was such an important part of the formative years of my life that I fell in love with the league. I fell in love with the whole experience. Met my wife there. My children's first language is Italian, so that was big. But what the sales pitch really goes back to our sport. American football, we're coming up on the Super Bowl, is our sport. And the sport was born in Ohio. And the sport made its way to Europe via, World War II, via the Jeep. So this whole story of, okay, these guys play American football. They work jobs so they can play at night. It's truly a game of passion is really where that story and that sales pitch starts. It takes you back to the days of like Johnny Unitas, Otto Graham, Deacon Jones, who had to work outside of playing.
It's right.
was much different for them than today's NFL stars. And so these are what I fell in love with when I played in this league is these guys that worked all day. They were physical therapists, pilots, laborers, whatever. They came from all walks of life, and football was this melting pot. Like it was many years ago,
right.
And this and still is.
For these players coming over here, and I mean, I know this is going back a little bit and kind of recovering. Already talked about ground, but for the players, was the Glass Bowl, was that an exciting venue for them?
Oh, it was a huge venue because these guys grew up on playing in modified soccer fields, and they're kind of it's the second chance sport for a lot of these guys who maybe played soccer up to a certain level and had to play in these fields. So to play in a Division I stadium, and the Glass Bowl is underrated. It is a beautiful stadium. I mean, every one of these guys that came from both Parma and Florence who spent that week on campus were just overwhelmed with one, how beautiful the American college experience can be, and then the Glass Bowl in and of itself is a beautiful stadium.
We always hear at college and in professional sports, home and home series, this has become more than that because obviously the game is in Italy this year, but then is coming back.
It's coming back.
So how was that all put together?
So we waited about a month because everybody who worked extremely hard from, all the volunteers, Buckeye and BCSN investing all their effort into it, everybody said, let's take a break. We have an agreement that, down the road, if it comes back, we have the opportunity to look at it. And so we waited about a month and then had a call with the Federation of American Football. And we said, guys, we had our month to kind of let things settle. And they said, hey, we want to do this again. And we said, yeah, you know what? We want to do this again. And we think Toledo wants to have it back again. And so...
And it's kind of an all hands on deck as far as support too. You guys have the RGP behind this. You already mentioned Buckeye and their support behind it. WTOL I know is a big supporter of it. But how do you make it better? We got about 30 seconds.
Yeah. So I think building on the momentum is key. RGP being a part of the sponsorship and now involving the business community. There are going to be two business forums in Italy that Jobs Ohio and RGP are going to run and be a part of it. A big win for us, a part of this first experience. Obviously, I have to say that John Grisham being at the game, taking his family vacation, putting it aside for a couple days to come watch the game was a huge success. So including him again in that. And if folks out there haven't read the book Playing for Pizza, it's about this league. It's a beautiful story about Italy, about American football, and this kind of fish out of water story. So kind of building on all those themes. And then I would also say, you're going to have the chance to follow these games again this year, and the Italian Bowl will be back in Italy in a beautiful city called Ravenna, right on the Adriatic coast. So if anybody's looking to travel, there would be no better, midsummer vacation than to spend some time on the beach and then see the Italian Bowl there.
But further down the road, July 1st, 2025, that's what we're talking.
Yes. So it'll probably
be
the last week of June in 2025. the Italian Bowl will be back in Toledo.
Nick, thank you. Thanks. Congratulations once again, and good luck going forward.
Thanks, Jeff.
Absolutely. We'll be back right after this. Welcome back. The nation's leading group of pediatricians warning parents that student athletes are at risk for injury and burnout. We asked two local coaches to get their take.
There's so much pressure on student athletes these days to get the scholarships, to go off to college and play. And a lot of it is coming from coaches, is coming from parents. There's so many more external pressures, you know, than I saw even when I was in high school. You have social media, you have the coaches who want the best, and you have kids playing year round multiple sports, and they're getting burned out. Mental health, mental awareness is the top factor right now. I think more and more people are talking about it, but as coaches, coming from the coach's point of view, we have to continue to do a better job of allowing these kids just to be kids. They have to have that time to be able to develop, not just physically, but mentally, emotionally, and socially. And when the pressure is on to be the best all the time, it's not allowing them to love life and enjoy it.
You look at your athletes who you are recruiting to bring into the Lourdes University volleyball program. These are guys who didn't just pick up the game yesterday. Now, there may be some flukes in there where there are some of those guys, but you want them to be at their best. You have to have them at their best in order to play at your level, correct?
And that's the tough part for us as collegiate coaches, is what do we want to see? You have to spend a lot of time in a sport to get that skilled in a sport. But if you spend too much time in that sport, do you get the burnout syndrome? Do you get the overuse injuries? Do you get all the negatives that go along with spending so much time in it? So, and that's the tough one, because it used to be that multi-sport athletes could still be very good at one or two or all of the sports. And those were the elite athletes, I guess, back in the day. The Bo Jacksons of the world, the Deion Sanders of the world were that elite of players. They didn't specialize in one sport. So is it an individual basis? I would still argue we're an individual basis. Do you have to play year-round in one sport to be good enough to play in college? I don't think so. But you have to be an elite-level athlete to play in college sports at the highest level. Now, we don't necessarily deal with the highest level like a Division I institution will deal with, but it's still a similar, like, to be at a certain level of skill, you have to play enough. So, I mean, it's a fine line.
Let me ask you both this, and Greg, I'll start with you, just from a sensitivity level and I guess an acute awareness of what you have to monitor. Has that changed as a coach?
There's definitely more involvement in how are you feeling? How are you doing today? Where's your injury level? Where's your body feeling than we used to concern with, for sure. Now, my background's more in sports medicine and kind of performance training. So I've always been more of that mode of thought. But you definitely, there's way more of the mental side now than there ever was. To check in to make sure that they're doing well. And that's been a big push really across the board.
McKenna, the study really looks at time off. And you subscribe to this. You think that it's definitely, season is one thing. But I guess the question is, when you look at a 12-month calendar, how much time off? How much is too much?
I think it's really going to depend on, you're going to deal with a lot of different coaching philosophies. And as a coach, you have to understand your players, which means you have to get to know them. What do they need in order to be as effective as possible in every different realm? You know, when it comes to summer things, there are some programs going 4 days a week where I'm like, we're going 2 days a week because I want them to go to the pool, go to the lake, have fun, have weeks off. So they still continue to enjoy it, because when they're doing it day in and day out, that love, that internal locus of control really starts to diminish, and their purpose, their why, begins to change at too early of an age. And so as coaches, as parents, we need to be really conscientious of that.
It's a slippery slope. You want these parents to raise these kids to be to strive for the best and to be competitive and to obviously do well at what they want to do well in. But I guess where does the blame go in any of this? When you're looking at this report and you're looking at the overuse, you're looking at the injuries. I know personally, I had a son who had labrum surgery before he was 17. I mean, these are things that, you know, just kind of make you scratch your head, Greg.
Yeah, I'm going to go with it's society as a whole. The pressures coming from the top down, the pressures coming from constantly comparing ourselves to other people. You know, with social media, with all of the media outlets of TikTok to Instagram to Snapchat, we're constantly seeing other people do something. And so we want to be that. But what we have to understand is we're our own person, and we just have to be inspired by other people and just stop comparing.
Well, once again, a big thank you to Venice Williams, Sandra McPherson, also Nick Ide, and Greg and McKenna Wrights for joining us this week on Leading Edge. And, of course, a big thank you to you for always carving out a part of your week to be with us. If you missed any part of our interviews, you can check out the WTOL 11 YouTube page. I'm Jeff Smith. Have a great rest of your week. We'll see you next time on Leading Edge.